Ever found yourself wondering why some students effortlessly grasp complex concepts while others struggle despite putting in hours of study? How Learning Works by Susan A. Ambrose and her colleagues at Carnegie Mellon University has become a cornerstone text in higher education for good reason. Endorsed by Nobel Prize winner Herbert Simon and praised by educational psychologists worldwide, this book distills decades of learning research into seven powerful principles that transform teaching effectiveness. What makes this work particularly valuable is how it bridges rigorous cognitive science with practical classroom applications, something rarely achieved in educational literature. As Oprah Winfrey once noted in her book club selection process, when education meets accessibility, that's when real change happens. This book exemplifies that intersection, explaining why even the most brilliant professors sometimes fail to reach their students, and providing evidence-based solutions that work across disciplines. Imagine walking into a room where everyone is speaking a language you barely understand. That's how many students feel when encountering new course material without adequate prior knowledge. What students already know fundamentally shapes how they interpret, organize, and incorporate new information. Prior knowledge acts as both foundation and filter. When accurate and activated appropriately, it creates mental hooks on which new knowledge can hang. Studies show people learn facts about familiar subjects twice as efficiently as unfamiliar ones. New knowledge literally sticks better when it has something to stick to. This explains why a business student might grasp marketing concepts more readily than physics principles, or why a history major might excel in literature courses that reference historical contexts they already understand. However, prior knowledge can also impede learning in several ways. Sometimes students possess accurate knowledge but fail to activate it when needed. In one fascinating study, students who knew how to solve one problem couldn't apply the same solution to an analogous problem until prompted. Then 80% succeeded. This demonstrates why instructors should explicitly connect new material to relevant concepts students already know. More problematically, students often bring insufficient or inaccurate knowledge to learning situations. A statistics professor might discover students claiming competence with statistical tests can't actually select appropriate ones for specific datasets, or students might misunderstand negative reinforcement in psychology because their everyday association of negative with bad interferes with learning the technical definition, removing something to increase behavior. Perhaps most challenging are deeply entrenched misconceptions that resist correction. Research shows 94% of students maintained incorrect beliefs about seasonal changes even after watching an explanatory video. These misconceptions persist because they've been reinforced over time, contain accurate elements alongside inaccuracies, and often work adequately for everyday explanations. Effective instructors address these challenges by first assessing what students know through diagnostic quizzes, concept mapping activities, or analyzing error patterns. They then activate relevant knowledge through exercises that prompt students to articulate existing knowledge before introducing new material. When gaps exist, they provide appropriate remediation, from self-study materials to review sessions or course redesign. For misconceptions, they employ bridging analogies that start with students' accurate knowledge and gradually build toward correct understanding, as when physics instructors help students understand that tables exert force by bridging from springs to foam to wood to solid tables. Have you ever wondered why experts and seemingly pluck solutions from thin air while novices struggle through methodical steps? The difference lies largely in how their knowledge is organized. Experts unconsciously maintain complex networks connecting important elements within their domains, organizing knowledge around meaningful features and abstract principles. Students, by contrast, typically haven't developed such connected ways of organizing information. This difference becomes apparent in how people approach problems. When presented with physics problems, novices organize them by surface features, pulley problems, inclined plane problems, while experts categorize by underlying physical principles, conservation of energy, Newton's laws. Similarly, chess masters don't memorize more individual pieces than novices. They recognize meaningful patterns that represent strategic situations. The density of connections in knowledge structures matters tremendously. Novices typically have sparse connections among knowledge elements, either disconnected nodes or simple chain structures. Art history students might organize paintings chronologically without understanding deeper stylistic relationships, while anatomy students might memorize body parts without grasping cross-system functional relationships. These limited organizations impede learning by making information retrieval difficult and allowing contradictory propositions to coexist unnoticed. Knowledge organization isn't merely an academic concern, it directly impacts performance. Studies show that when students are provided with organizational structures for new information, they learn 60 to 350% better than when left to deduce structures themselves. This dramatic improvement occurs because well-organized knowledge allows efficient access, enables processing information in meaningful chunks, and facilitates building larger knowledge networks. To help students develop more effective knowledge organizations, instructors can create concept maps that visualize relationships between ideas, analyze tasks to identify appropriate knowledge organization for specific assignments, and share the organizational structure of courses and individual lectures. Using contrasting cases helps students identify deep features rather than superficial similarities, while making connections between concepts explicit builds more flexible knowledge application. Monitoring students' knowledge organization through concept mapping exercises, sorting tasks, and patterns of mistakes reveals misconceptions that can be addressed directly. The goal isn't imposing a single correct organization. Different organizations serve different purposes, but helping students develop rich, interconnected structures based on meaningful features that match the tasks they need to perform. Why do some students eagerly tackle challenging material while others do the minimum required? The answer lies in motivation, the personal investment in reaching desired outcomes that influences the direction, intensity, persistence, and quality of learning behaviors. Motivation requires two essential components: subjective value and expectations for success. Value comes in multiple forms: attainment value, satisfaction from mastery, intrinsic value, enjoyment, and instrumental value, helping accomplish other goals. These sources often work in combination. A task initially done for a grade may develop intrinsic value as knowledge grows. Expectations are equally crucial. Outcome expectations, belief that actions lead to desired outcomes, and efficacy expectations, belief in one's capability to execute necessary actions. Students' attributions for past successes and failures strongly influence these expectations. Attributing success to ability or effort builds confidence, while attributing failure to controllable factors maintains motivation. Consider two contrasting scenarios. Professor Hill assumes students share his passion for primary sources in continental philosophy, while Professor Robles tries to motivate through warnings about course difficulty. Both approaches fail because they don't address both value and expectations. Professor Hill students don't see value in working with primary sources, while Professor Robles's warnings about difficulty undermine students' expectations for success. When students value a goal, expect success, and perceive a supportive environment, motivation is highest. Different combinations of these factors create distinct behavioral patterns, ranging from rejecting to highly motivated. Understanding these dynamics allows instructors to strategically enhance student motivation. To establish value, instructors can connect material to students' interests through relevant topics, provide authentic, real-world tasks that demonstrate practical applications, and explicitly show relevance to students' academic progression. Demonstrating the importance of higher-level skills to future professional lives helps students recognize the value of skills like writing and teamwork across disciplines. Building positive expectations requires ensuring alignment between objectives, assessments, and teaching strategies, identifying appropriate challenge levels, providing early success opportunities, clearly articulating expectations, and delivering targeted feedback. Educating students about attribution patterns for success and failure helps them develop realistic expectations. Addressing both value and expectations simultaneously can be achieved by providing flexibility and control through meaningful choices aligned with students' goals, which contributes to their sense of ownership and expectation of success. Giving students opportunities to reflect on their learning helps them identify the value of their work and develop specific strategies that leverage their strengths, bolstering expectations for future success. What separates true mastery from mere familiarity with a subject? Tasks that seem simple to instructors often involve complex combinations of skills. Like learning to drive requires integrating numerous steps, facts, and skills, academic mastery follows a similar pattern. Students must acquire component skills, practice integrating them, and know when to apply what they have learned. Expertise follows a four-stage developmental trajectory from novice to expert: unconscious incompetence, not knowing what they don't know; conscious incompetence, awareness of knowledge gaps; conscious competence, deliberate skill application; and finally, unconscious competence, automatic, instinctive performance. This progression creates an expert blind spot. Instructors struggle to break down skills, skip steps unconsciously, underestimate learning time, and overestimate students' transfer abilities. Consider Professor Solomon's industrial management course, where student groups underperform on team projects despite doing well individually. The professor expected group projects to exceed individual work quality because more people can share the workload and generate ideas. However, successful teamwork requires not just content knowledge, but also process skills, like delegating tasks, coordinating efforts, resolving conflicts, and synthesizing contributions, skills the professor assumed students already possessed. Similarly, Professor Kozel's acting students mastered fundamental movement, voice, and speech skills separately, but struggled to integrate them effectively in performance. When students must combine multiple skills simultaneously, performance often degrades due to cognitive load limitations. The total information processing demands exceed what people can manage. Experts experience less cognitive load because their highly practiced component skills become automated, requiring fewer cognitive resources. Mastery also requires knowing when and where to apply skills. Transfer, applying skills learned in one context to another, is a central educational goal, yet occurs neither often nor automatically. Students struggle with transfer because they may associate knowledge too closely with the original learning context, or they may lack understanding of underlying principles, the why behind practices. Research shows transfer improves when students combine concrete experience with abstract principles, make structured comparisons between cases, engage in analogical reasoning, use visual representations, articulate causal relationships, and receive prompting from instructors. In one study, students who memorized a military strategy couldn't apply it to an analogous medical problem until prompted to consider the connection, showing how a little guidance can significantly improve transfer. To build mastery, instructors should systematically identify component skills by repeatedly asking, "What would students need to know to achieve this task?" and decomposing complex tasks until all components are identified. Providing focused practice increases automaticity and fluency, while temporarily constraining tasks reduces cognitive load while students develop integration skills. To facilitate transfer, instructors should discuss conditions of applicability, provide diverse practice contexts, ask students to generalize to larger principles, and use structured comparisons to help identify deep features versus surface characteristics. Not all practice is equal. Students must focus on areas needing improvement rather than what they already know, and without proper feedback, even focused practice can entrench errors. Goal-directed practice coupled with targeted feedback creates an effective learning cycle that maximizes learning efficiency. Research shows learning is best fostered when practice focuses on specific goals, targets appropriate challenge levels, and occurs with sufficient frequency. Deliberate practice, working towards specific goals, predicts continued learning better than generic practice. Expert musicians spend time monitoring performance against particular goals, then pushing toward new ones. Goals focus students' attention on relevant material and allow progress monitoring. However, instructors often fail to convey specific goals clearly to students. Professor Strait's vague criteria of substantive anthropological arguments carried specific meaning to her, but not to her novice students, who defaulted to prior experience. Effective goals are stated as observable student behaviors that can be measured, like explaining a concept to a particular audience, rather than vague directives like understanding a concept. Practice must be at an appropriate challenge level, neither too hard, causing struggle and errors, nor too easy, requiring little effort. This connects to Vygotsky's zone of proximal development, where instructional scaffolding, adding structure and support, helps students practice at appropriate challenge levels. This support can come from peers or written prompts and maintains motivation by helping students feel tasks are reasonable. Even high-quality practice requires sufficient quantity for benefits to accumulate. The learning curve isn't linear. Early and late phases show flatter improvement than the middle phase. This occurs partly because measurement tools are less sensitive at extremes, and partly because practice tasks often pose inappropriate challenges, too difficult for beginners and too easy for experts. Goal-directed practice must be paired with targeted feedback to maximize learning. Like a GPS that not only shows distance from destination but provides directions, effective feedback identifies how current performance differs from goals and suggests adjustments. Research shows feedback is most effective when it identifies specific aspects needing improvement rather than providing generic evaluations. Timing feedback properly involves both how soon it's given, typically earlier is better, and how often, more frequently, is generally better. More frequent feedback typically leads to more efficient learning by helping students address errors before they become entrenched. However, immediate feedback isn't always ideal. In some cases, delayed feedback better supports the development of self-correction skills. To create effective goal-directed practice, instructors should make learning goals explicit, use rubrics to communicate performance criteria clearly, build in multiple shorter practice opportunities, incorporate scaffolding, and provide examples of target performance. For effective feedback, they should look for patterns of errors across student work, prioritize feedback on key aspects, balance feedback on strengths and weaknesses, and consider providing feedback at the group level when appropriate. Students are not merely intellectual beings, but also social and emotional ones, and these dimensions interact within the classroom environment to influence learning outcomes. While college students experience significant social, emotional, and intellectual development, these emotions can overwhelm their intellect if they haven't learned to channel them productively. Student-centered teaching requires recognizing the complex challenges college students face. Beyond academic demands, students aged 17 to 22 are establishing independence, building new social networks, negotiating differences with peers, managing finances, making decisions about personal behaviors, and encountering ideas that challenge their existing values. Chickering's model systematically accounts for developmental changes through 7 cumulative vectors: developing competence, intellectual, physical, interpersonal, managing emotions, developing autonomy, establishing identity, freeing interpersonal relationships, developing purpose, and developing integrity. These vectors shape how students engage with course content, their motivation, and their sense of identity in their chosen field. Intellectual development progresses through qualitative shifts in thinking. In early stages, students exhibit dualistic thinking, viewing knowledge as absolute right-wrong statements delivered by authorities. When challenged by questions without clear answers, they move to multiplicity, where knowledge becomes a matter of opinions, all seemingly equally valid. With sufficient emphasis on evidence-based reasoning, students advance to relativism, recognizing that opinions must be evaluated according to disciplinary standards. Social identity development, how students identify with certain social groups, is particularly salient for college students. Various models follow similar trajectories, culminating in positive group identity. The process begins with a naive stage, without prejudice, followed by acceptance of societal messages about different groups. Many students remain here unless challenged, potentially moving to resistance where they become acutely aware of societal isms. Successfully navigating this stage leads to redefinition and internalization, where identity becomes one aspect of self rather than a defining feature. Course climate encompasses the intellectual, social, emotional, and physical environments in which students learn. It's shaped by faculty-student interaction, instructor tone, stereotyping, course demographics, student-student interaction, and the perspectives represented in course content. Beyond obviously offensive stereotypes, subtle stereotype activation can profoundly impact learning through stereotype threat. This occurs when members of stereotyped groups fear being judged according to those stereotypes, negatively affecting their performance regardless of ability. Simply having African-American students indicate their race before taking a standardized test activated negative stereotypes and significantly depressed their performance. Course climate extends beyond identity factors to how instructors communicate with students. Even identical course policies worded differently, punitively versus encouragingly, significantly influence students' perceptions of instructor approachability and willingness to seek help. When students perceive faculty as interested in their academic problems, approachable outside class, and treating them as individuals rather than numbers, this positively impacts retention, graduate school attendance rates, and self-reported critical thinking skills. To promote student development and productive climate, instructors should model inclusive language and behavior, use multiple diverse examples, establish ground rules for interaction, ensure course content doesn't marginalize students, set up processes to get feedback on climate, anticipate sensitive issues, address tensions early, turn discord into learning opportunities, and facilitate active listening. Why do some students continue to struggle despite putting in hours of effort? Consider Melanie, who starts her history paper at the last minute, and John, who studies diligently but ineffectively for chemistry exams. Both perform below expectations without understanding why. Despite different approaches, both students fail to recognize the shortcomings in their strategies or adapt to new intellectual challenges. The core issue is metacognition, the process of reflecting on and directing one's own thinking. To become self-directed learners, students must learn to assess the demands of the task, evaluate their own knowledge and skills, plan their approach, monitor their progress, and adjust their strategies as needed. Research models of metacognition share the fundamental concept that learners must engage in cyclical processes to monitor and control their learning. Students often struggle with accurately assessing tasks, frequently ignoring assignment instructions, and defaulting to familiar strategies from previous educational experiences. They also typically overestimate their abilities, with weaker students being particularly poor at self-assessment. When planning, students tend to spend too little time on this crucial phase compared to experts, and their plans often don't match the task requirements. Research shows that students who naturally monitor their progress and explain concepts to themselves while learning achieve better outcomes, and teaching self-monitoring skills improves learning gains. However, even when students identify problems in their approach, they may resist changing strategies due to perceived costs in time and effort. Students' beliefs about intelligence and learning profoundly influence their metacognitive processes. Whether they view learning as fast and easy or slow and difficult, and whether they perceive intelligence as fixed or malleable, affects their approach to learning. Students who believe intelligence is fixed see little reason to invest effort, while those who believe it's malleable engage more deeply with challenging material. To help students develop metacognitive skills, instructors should be more explicit than they might think necessary about task requirements, providing clear performance criteria with assignments. Early performance-based assessments with timely feedback help students accurately evaluate their abilities. For complex assignments, providing model plans with interim deadlines helps students understand the components of complex tasks and their logical sequencing. Equipping students with simple heuristics for self-correction, requiring reflection and annotation of work, and including formal reflection requirements in assignments all help students develop metacognitive awareness.
Exam wrappers, short handouts completed when exams are returned, guide students through analyzing their performance and connecting it to study methods. Addressing students' limiting beliefs about learning directly, broadening their understanding of knowledge types, and giving realistic expectations about skill development timeframes all support metacognitive development. Modeling your own metacognitive processes by thinking aloud and providing scaffolding that gradually diminishes as students develop mastery further enhance these essential skills.
The seven learning principles we've explored are powerful tools that explain a wide range of learning behaviors and inform effective course design. What's particularly valuable is recognizing that these same principles apply to us as instructors, as we too are still learning about teaching. Teaching is a complex activity requiring constant adaptation, and most of us lack formal pedagogical training. Rather than seeking static perfection, we should approach teaching as a process of progressive refinement guided by these very principles. Like our students, we possess prior knowledge that affects our teaching. This includes our content expertise, necessary but insufficient, misconceptions, like believing good teaching requires an entertaining personality, and our own learning experiences, which may not translate to our students. Learning about our students provides crucial context that helps us build on our prior knowledge and tailor our teaching appropriately. Many instructors begin with compartmentalized teaching knowledge organized by course features rather than deeper principles. The learning principles presented in this book offer a more meaningful structure for organizing teaching knowledge, creating a flexible framework that transfers across different teaching contexts. Our motivation to improve teaching depends on both value and expectation. We value efficiency, strategies that require upfront investment but yield long-term time savings, like rubrics, satisfy this need. Maintaining motivation requires setting realistic teaching goals, perhaps focusing on improving just one or two aspects per semester rather than attempting wholesale changes. Teaching mastery requires acquiring component skills, integrating them, and applying them appropriately. Discussion facilitation alone demands multiple sub-skills, posing questions, listening empathetically, maintaining flow, correcting misconceptions, and managing time. We need fluency in each skill to reduce cognitive load, plus the ability to determine when and where different teaching strategies are most applicable. Developing teaching mastery requires coupling practice with feedback. End-of-semester evaluations come too late for immediate improvement. Formative feedback throughout the term, from early evaluations, student management teams, colleagues, and teaching centers, is more valuable. When we think of teaching as deliberate practice, we can target specific skills needing development. As instructors, we undergo intellectual development, moving from seeking pedagogical magic bullets to understanding teaching as contextual decision-making focused on student learning. Our teaching identity also evolves as we develop competence, autonomy, integrity, and appropriate classroom presence. The principles in this book help us become more metacognitive about our teaching. Self-directed improvement requires engaging in a cyclical process, assessing our strengths and weaknesses, planning effective approaches, monitoring progress, evaluating outcomes, and making adjustments. Being aware of our core beliefs about teaching and learning is essential. If we view teaching as a developable skill rather than an innate talent, we're more likely to engage in continuous improvement through reflection, collaboration, and professional development. By applying these principles to our own practice, we not only become more effective teachers, but also model the very learning processes we hope to instill in our students, creating a virtuous cycle of improvement that benefits everyone in the educational community.